Hello, and welcome to this 8th episode of Season 5 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Well, hello, Ray.
Now, Graham, one of the interesting things I've discovered about our podcast in studying closely our download and listener statistics is how popular certain episodes turn out to be compared with others.
Yeah, I've noticed that whenever we do something along the lines of an introduction to whatever, it tends to get a good level of take-up.
Indeed. So we'll make sure we keep seeding a few of those in the feed, in and among the more topical stuff that we know helps people stay up to date on the financial crime news of the day.
Good idea, Ray. And today we've got an introductory episode again, haven't we?
Yes, I had to check, but it seems we've never actually touched on the subject of sanctions, which feels like a really important omission.
Ray, I agree. And although it's entirely possible to work in anti-financial crime for a long time without really getting much experience in the sanctions space, there's an increasing interrelation between sanctions, fraud, money laundering and other financial crimes. That means nobody can afford to be ignorant, at least of the high-level risks.
No, I think that's exactly right. And what we want to do today is to highlight those key risks through exploring the sanctions world at quite a high level. We can always come back another time and look at certain aspects more deeply.
Indeed, Ray. Should we start then by clarifying what sanctions are and why they exist?
Knock yourself out, Graham.
Well, all right then. Often, different sovereign governments have differing opinions on how it is acceptable for a state to behave. One country may object to the actions of another or its people for a number of reasons.
They might judge the other state's actions as insufficiently respectful of human rights, for instance, or as in breach of international law on matters like terrorism or occupying territory that doesn't belong to them.
It may not be the entire state whose actions are beyond the pale, though. It might be certain individuals or organisations, although there is usually an element of their actions being, well, state-sponsored or state-supported, or at least state-tolerated.
And then again, the source of the sanctions might be political opposition, where a state would not want to allow any military advantage it might hold to be eroded through helping to arm its opponent.
Now, clearly, a state would not sell arms to its opponent, but often it's not that clear. A commercial company that sells arms or arms components might be based in a particular country, but seek to gain its revenue internationally and will not be as invested in its home country's political agenda, maybe as the country's government.
Also, there's the phenomenon of dual-use goods, Graham. Or it may not be evident that an export of innocuous commodities might be put to unanticipated use once in the end user's hands.
And the obvious examples here might be agricultural fertiliser that can fuel bombs and computers or computer components that can guide missiles.
Quite so.
And sanctions, of course, can be used when a government or governments find themselves unable to influence a misbehaving state to stop the misbehaviour through diplomatic or legal means and use sanctions as an economic tool to try and force the rogue state to fall into line.
Now, sometimes this can work, other times not so much.
I often think of the US sanctions against Cuba that were in place for years without seeming to have much of an impact on Cuba's government.
Although we have no experience of the counterfactual situation in which conceivably Cuba could have gained greater influence in the region and the world and fueled a wider alliance to resist US hegemony.
That's true. As financial institutions, though, we are interested less in questions of effectiveness and justification for sanctions rules than we are in assiduously observing them.
Oh, that's right, Graham. And the reason why is fairly obvious. Failing to observe applicable sanctions requirements is criminal, and inevitably causes legal, financial and reputational jeopardy to institutions.
So let's just take some time, Ray, to look at the different types of sanctions that might be in place and what institutions are required to do in respect of each of them.
Yeah, let's do that. One major caveat is that exactly what sanctions you need to observe isn't always straightforward. It might depend not only on where your institution is based, but on other countries it operates in and offers services to, currencies it handles, even the nationalities of its staff.
Indeed. So if we do succeed in simplifying the topic for this episode, we must also get across that there is lots of tricky detail that can trip you up, and there's no substitute for a conversation with a local sanctions specialist when it comes to specific issues, someone who knows the detail and also knows your firm and its exposures.
So, complexity, yes. But the whole country risk piece is packed with complexity, Graham. Isn't sanctions just another element in our country risk ratings?
I can see why you might say that, Ray, in your case, in a kind of rhetorical sense, I understand that. But it's not that simple. When you regard a country as a high-risk one, and bear in mind the risk we're talking about is going to be the risk of money laundering, terrorist financing or other financial crimes, but by labelling it as a high-risk country, you're saying you need to apply certain controls when this country is a factor in your client relationship. You can still make payments to the country. You can still give its citizens accounts, provided you recognise the risks and control for them. Try that with a country that's subject to comprehensive sanctions and your bank will be toast.
I see. So these are what they often call prohibited countries rather than high-risk countries. But you used a term there that we ought to explore, comprehensive sanctions.
Yeah, that's the sanctions equivalent of a nuke, really. It's what it's what happens when your nation is held to be utterly beyond the pale. Not just people or organisations within it, but the entire state. And this is a very small club of nations.
If I'm right, it's Iran, Sudan, North Korea, Syria, Cuba.
As per the mnemonic, I should not keep such customers.
So, comprehensive sanctions basically prohibit you from touching the country concerned. The aim of the comprehensive sanctions regime is to deny the state any access to international financial markets and systems, right?
Yep, that's correct. There tends to be international consensus about these countries everywhere outside their own borders, which is why the regime is largely, I say largely, viable.
Now, you say that, Graham, but the first country on that list is Iran. And there isn't quite that consensus as we speak, is there?
Well, no, and it's a fair point, Ray, hence the largely. When the US reimposed comprehensive sanctions on Iran, it was in the face of strenuous objections from the EU and other countries.
Why is that, Graham?
Politics, Ray. Leading nations had been working collectively to encourage Iran to expose its nuclear program to international inspection, so it could be steered to a purely civilian power generation purpose rather than a military one. US foreign policy changed considerably, and suddenly international agreements were set aside. America took its carrot back and reintroduced its stick.
But this was only the US position.
Well, yeah, that is right, Ray, but the word only is having to do an awful lot of work there. The point is that the US, thanks to the predominance of its currency, is just able to impose these measures everywhere in the world where the dollar's important.
Which is everywhere.
Well, pretty much. Technically, if you are a regional European bank, say, without a dollar clearing licence and no need to transact in dollars, if you have no customers or staff who are US nationals, well, then you can disregard the OFAC sanctions against Iran, sort of.
OFAC, we should mention, is the Office of Foreign Asset Control. It's the US agency that's responsible for maintaining sanctions programs.
Yeah, there are a lot of initials in the sanctions world, Ray. Mm. OFAC also maintain the SDN list, for example.
Yes, that's the specially designated nationals and blocked persons list. And it exemplifies the DEFCON 2 of sanctions. These aren't entire countries being sanctioned, but particular individuals.
Indeed. These may be people associated with terrorism, for instance, or grand corruption, or other actions that are associated with specific people rather than their entire state.
And this is an example of targeted sanctions, right?
Yeah. I mean, we looked at comprehensive sanctions, which is a blanket measure to cover the whole state. The alternative is targeted sanctions, whether the measures cover only specific people or specific entities or sometimes specific economic activities or sectors in a country.
Individuals and entities, I can see, but do you have an example of a sanctioned sector?
Well, one would be long-term debt instruments in Russia, and there are a whole raft of them in Venezuela.
So if you're on this SDN list as an individual, a bank is prohibited from having any dealings with you at all. How does that work with sectoral sanctions?
Well, it's the activity that you can't engage in that situation. Let's take the Russian debt piece, for instance. This was established in 2014 following the annexation of Crimea. It applies to certain Russian finance and energy businesses, and it prevents any engagement in those businesses' long-term debt financing.
So they can still be your customers, you just have to restrict what you do for them.
Yes, unless those specific individuals or entities are also sanctioned in their own right, by which I mean on the SDN list, for instance.
Got it. Now we've skirted a bit around the question of jurisdictional reach, haven't we? But we've established that the US issued sanctions are pretty much globally applicable, putting the issue of Iran to one side.
That's right.
Is anyone else issuing globally relevant sanctions?
Well, the UN declares sanctions, which you'd like to think would have common currency.
Well, yes. Then there's EU sanctions, which all member states are committed to observing. And it's worth saying there's a good deal of overlap between OFAC, the UN and the EU lists, Iran aside.
Each EU member state can also issue its own sanctions too.
Yes, Her Majesty's Treasury has always issued its own list, which beyond the end of this year also replaces the EU list for UK entities for their purely UK affairs.
So we're used to advising UK firms to monitor four sanctions lists as a minimum: OFAC from the US, the UN list, the EU list and the HM Treasury list. But I guess from next year it will be three. I don't believe that will mean many people or entities disappearing off the consolidated list, though.
I think that's right. But let's come at this from a different angle, Graham. I'm subject to sanctions, and it's cramping my style, to put it mildly. I can't make or receive payments or engage in any kind of international trade. I can't travel. I can't invest.
I think that's the idea, right?
Well, yes. But I might still attempt to do some or all of those things. How can I hope to go about that in a way that won't trigger alarms?
Well, I think first we ought to look at the kinds of alarms that might sound. Organisations check for sanctions evasion at the client onboarding stage and in ongoing monitoring.
Generally, they will have tech that screens client and associated party names against all relevant sanctions lists, and they'll investigate any hits, which are often false positives from fuzzy matching.
And then those same checks will be performed regularly. In many organisations, that's as often as daily, but some may do it less frequently for some or all its clients on a risk-based approach.
That's because these lists can and do change, and a name that got through initial onboarding might subsequently appear on a list today for the first time, and unless you rescreen all the names in your client base, you wouldn't necessarily know.
That's absolutely right, Ray. And in ongoing monitoring, it won't just be clients who are screened, right?
No, you'd also look at third parties who might be remitting to your clients or to whom your clients might be making payments.
And of course, there are all the trade-related, largely manual checks that we know trade finance departments have to undertake.
Yep.
So, how are you as an individual or a firm subject to sanctions going to seek to evade them?
There are only two ways that you can, Graham.
And what are those?
Well, you can either get banks and bank staff to help you break the law.
That's a bold choice, Ray.
Well, yes, I'd say so. Or you can try to obscure your identity,
through using intermediaries or by wrapping corporate and legal entities around your interests.
Or in other words, employing the same tools you would also use to conceal money laundering?
Pretty much, Graham. I mean, hence the identification of UPOs and associated parties is at the core of all sanctions defences, as well as money laundering defences.
So, effectively, AML controls are also sanctions controls.
Yes, they are. But you'll find that reasonable measures might give you more leeway to take a risk-based approach for AML than it does for sanctions.
And I think that's definitely reflected in the enforcement records, isn't it, Ray? Mm. There's way less nuance when regulators censor and fine on sanctions than on money laundering failings.
That's true.
Well, look, I think that's probably a reasonable introduction to sanctions. I still can't believe it's the first time we've really touched on it. And I think we'll revisit aspects of it in more depth in the future.
Yep, I expect so. Where should we go next, Graham?
Well, Ray, the government recently published the latest annual SARS report. And although it's UK-centric, I still think it's worth a look at because there's stuff that everyone can learn.
I'm looking forward to it.